We'll come to order. The House Special Committee on Ways and Means is called to order, and it's March 3rd, 2005. President or Representative Moses, Representative Seaton, Representative Wilson, myself, Representative Wyrock. And today we wanted to continue our overview on various tax alternatives. And without having bills before us, what we wanted to do is look at the alternative income tax measures. First, what we were going to do is look at the state of Alaska used to have an income tax that was repealed by Governor Jay Hammond at the request of the legislature in the early 1980s after we started receiving tremendous amounts of money from the oil pipeline. And then when the fiscal gap became acute over the last few years, there were two bills that were introduced that would have reinstituted an income tax. Representative Moses had introduced a income tax bill, and Representative Wilson had introduced an income tax bill. Both of those operated differently than the original bill, original statute that the state of Alaska had, and differed in how they would act, both in terms of obtaining revenues and in terms of the timing of when the revenues would be obtained from the public, and finally the amount of revenues that would be obtained under each one of those three different scenarios. And so as part of the committee's deliberations on determining alternative revenue measures, one of the first things we wanted to do is look at the income tax scenario and look at those different bills as they may affect our long-term fiscal picture. Joining us is Representative Samuels. Morning.
Good morning.
One thing I had read last night in the New York Times was Alan Greenspan, the Federal Reserve Chairman, had talked about the U.S. tax policies and talked about what was called a consumption tax and trying to look at structural changes to the United States tax system from an income tax-based system to a consumption-based taxation. And essentially the upshot of the article is that a consumption tax in lieu of an income tax would promote savings and tax only on consumption and not on income. And it is an interesting article, I think, for your files to put in, to have and read at your leisure, but I thought it was at least a dialogue that's taking place at the national level that may benefit dialogue here in the state level. Representative Wilson.
I heard also, and this was kind of frightening to me, they mentioned that it was just mentioned, the possibility, and I'm sure it's just in the thinking process at this time, but the possibility of a federal sales tax.
Mm-hmm. And that would be basically the consumption tax.
Yeah.
We're probably a long way from that, just given the dialogue in the national level about Social Security. So let's see, for the Department of Revenue, we have, who's online? We have Brett Freed. He's an economist with the Department of Revenue. Mr. Freed, are you online?
No,
no one's online yet. Is anyone present?
No, they should be online, Mr. Miles. I can give them a call.
We'll take a quick at ease. Representative Roekberg, good morning.
Yes, sir.
We had today from the Department of Revenue three individuals who are going to talk about these alternative bills, and just briefly, Representative Roekberg, we were going to look at these three income tax proposals. Number one, the statute that was in place in the early 80s and the early part of the state's history that had an income tax. And the second proposal was Representative Moses' income tax bill, and the third was Representative Wilson's income tax bill, and determine what alternative implementation of those would mean to the state's fiscal picture. So we have Brett Freed, an economist with Department of Revenue, Michael Williams, Department of Revenue, and Dan Dickinson, Director of Tax Division. And I had talked briefly with folks at Department of Revenue and Commissioner Corbis a week ago, and simply wanted to get some basic information and then some committee deliberation on first what would be the fiscal impact if these bills would be implemented? What would be the revenue to the state? What would be the alternative publics that would be affected by these, and what would be the timing of the revenues, because some of the income taxes would kick in at certain times and some would be a more static approach to revenue generation. So, gentlemen, who wanted to start with just presentation of the basic information to the committee?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. This is Dan Dickinson, Director of the Tax Division.
Good morning, Mr. Dickinson.
Mr. Chairman, it really is up to you. That what Brett Fried is going to be speaking about is the question that was put to you. I think Representative Seaton and you, Mr. Chairman, discussed this notion of what might you do to measure sort of various sectors of the economy and then look at their relative contribution, their tax contribution to the state versus their relative contribution to the overall economic activity in the state. Mike Williams is the gentleman who has done the comparison between, as you said, the prior law, then HB 470 from last year's session, and HB 321 from last year's session. I guess my role will be to introduce them. I've got some of the publications about our individual income tax as it was back when it was last passed last assessed in 1979. But Mike has got more overall numbers to sort of compare the three. So it's really up to you which of those presentations you'd like to hear first, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Dickinson, why don't you just give the general overview and set the stage on the three bills, and then we'll go from there.
I'm going to ask Michael to set the stage and to give that overview, if I might. Mike Williams, an auditor with our division.
Okay, through the chair, my name is Mike Williams. I'm a revenue auditor with the Department of Revenue.
Good morning.
A comparison that I put together, I don't know if the committee has been given a chart that I prepared, the chart that I prepared shows the total revenue that would be generated under prior law.
Mr. Williams?
As it existed.
Mr. Williams? Mr. Williams? Mr. Williams? Can you hear me? Mr. Williams?
Are we on mute? I can hear you fine.
Okay, just a minute. I'm not sure we do have the chart that you're referring to, so...
Okay. We'll make sure that the committee gets the chart. Or if you... Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, this is Dan Dickinson. If you have several charts, it's the one printed out. It's the one on legal size paper. Title is Projected Income Tax Revenue Comparison of Three Proposals.
All right.
It's in that file of the...
Okay. This is in the committee's file called Oversight Hearing on Income Taxes. Is it back in the table, too?
They're all gone from there, but yes, sir.
Okay. All right. Go ahead.
Yes. Under the way I approach this, because there are different ramp-up provisions in HB 470 and HB 321, basically, excuse me, took the total annual revenue beyond the third year, that way you would have a fuller comparison of in a full implementation year how much revenue would each bill generate. Under prior law, our best information available says that if prior law were still in place, we would annually collect a little more than $750 million a year in personal income taxes.
Just a sec, Mr. Williams. Could you just briefly discuss the acronyms in your chart here, AGI?
That's adjusted gross income. Basically, this particular chart shows how much total aggregate revenue from each gross income class would the state receive. In other words, this is this particular breakdown of gross income. So, for example, incomes less than 20,000, incomes from 20,000 to 30,000, so on and so forth, up to the top end of incomes greater than 200,000. That particular breakdown, it mirrors information that I get from the Internal Revenue Service, and so a lot of standard approaches where I present information, I use this particular breakdown for comparative purposes, and so it's the aggregate revenue from each class of income or percentile of income, if you will. But in total, the prior law would as I said, generate $758 million. Our best information available is that under House Bill 470, in the full adoption year, it would generate about $107 million. and House Bill 321 would generate approximately $300 million. And the provisions within House Bill 470 with the property tax credit, that particular provision complicates my ability to give you an accurate representation in each of the different income categories as to how much revenue comes from each percentile of income.
Now, this is these figures in the total at the far right are gross revenue, not counting for any of the overhead generated by the state of Alaska in just implementing the bills, correct?
That is correct. Right. Also, as I mentioned earlier, that this is beyond the third year because House Bill 470 has a ramp up the provision. For example, it only would generate 5% on tax liabilities up to $20,000 and 10% for tax liabilities over $20,000 in the first year. And in its second year, it's only 10% of federal tax liability up to $20,000 and 15% over $20,000. And so for the first year of 470, we might only expect to see about $19 million. And then for the first year of the second year of House Bill 470, we might only see about $55 million. So the ramp-up provisions limit its revenue potential.
Okay, Representative Wilson, you had a question?
Mr. Williams, do you have any idea under House Bill 321, because there's a cap in there, do you know what that would be without that cap?
The revenue that I've projected here does not include that cap, but my note on that page says that I have some data limitations that I really can't tell you how on the top end what we're losing, what we would lose because of that cap, but there will be some revenue escapement or loss or cap because of you've capped it at a tax liability of $20,000 for a single person and $30,000 for married filing joint. So presumably at some point for incomes over $1 million, there will be their maximum tax liability will only be $30,000 to the state.
Yeah, I think... Follow-up.
Mm, sure.
I think that was a committee substitute, after we had had testimony from all over, then we made all these little adjustments because of the testimony that was given. So a lot of those little twists and turns in that bill were because of testimony we received. So I was just wondering what would happen if some of those weren't in there. So.
The $300 million projection does not take into account the cap.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions at this point? Okay, go ahead, Mr. Williams. Anything else?
No, there's a second page. It's called Comparative Analysis. Landscape on a regular size, but I basically took the three bills and did a bunch of what-if scenarios of different... First column is a child under age 14, and the final column is a dual-income family with $520,000 in gross income, and it shows you what their federal tax liability is, and then it shows you what the tax liability under the three different bills would be, and then at the bottom it gives you kind of an effective rate of that's basically their Alaska tax divided by their federal taxable income to give you a kind of an effective rate. Of what the marginal rate is on that.
Okay, we're joined by Representative Grunberg. Representative Grunberg, we're in a committee file, an oversight file around these two matrices.
But the what-if scenarios there that just show you the tax that would be due under the three different bills is really just that's it. It's a what-if. It's not really representative. I can't say with any certainty that the single income family is a predominant situation in Alaska. It's just the bill's impact, any given bill's impact on a family will depend upon the deductions, the credits, and whatever the rates that you choose to set in that particular bill. with that, Mr. Chairman, that's all the more that I have, unless there's any specific questions.
Representative Wilson, under your bill, after Ways and Means reported it out last year, wasn't there some link to the amount in the Constitutional Budget Reserve? Some.
Why?
Mr. Chairman, this is Mike Williams.
Yeah, Mr. Williams.
The copy of House Bill 321 that I have does not have any link to the CBR.
Representative Roper.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think you're talking about a trigger mechanism that we were discussing. Mm-hmm. One of my more favorite devices, mm-hmm. but I don't know if it was ever, we never actually amended any of the bills to include that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Any further questions of Mr. Williams or the data? Representative Seaton.
Just on the data, I was looking down at the last one we're looking at it, down at the bottom where we're talking about a dual income family with over $225,000 mortgage, and the previous one are under House Bill 470. Is that correct that there would be no income tax paid by either of those categories?
Through the chair, Representative Stevens, that's my understanding of the mechanism of House Bill 470. It has a property tax credit provision. And the assumption is that these individuals are living in a city or a borough with a property tax, so it's more than likely that they have paid sufficient property taxes such that it would wipe out their Alaska income tax liability.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Mr. Williams, what percent of the people of Alaska fall in those two categories then? How much would we be losing there?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that's a very difficult question to answer. The Bureau of Census, U.S. Bureau of Census information that I have shows that home ownership in Alaska is roughly 67%, but as to how that's distributed on the income spectrum, we don't have any correlation of that data back against income data.
So that could be substantial then, couldn't it?
You're very correct that the property tax credit provision is very substantial in that bill.
Yeah, Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, are we going to go through these other bills or the background first? These are
the overview.
Overview here. So are we going to go through those at all? Or?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Why don't we?
I'm happy to do that. I wanted to give the sort of this introduction on these and then
right.
look
we're
at the money.
Into some of the particulars of it.
That's right.
Mr. Chairman, I was just trying to find out if those were anomalies in this comparison, if the comparisons
were correct.
No, they're
not. They're designed into it. That's why we need, if we're going to talk about each bill, we should talk about each bill
right.
before we start.
What I want to do is get a general overview first and then go into the specific. Representative Seaton.
That's fine. I'll.
Representative Sanders.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have a question for revenue on, I'm going to make an assumption here, is the numbers on the, where it says Alaska income tax prior law, HB 470, HB 321, those are numbers that are the revenues that would be given to the state, but if you can write them off in your federal income taxes, would that number be less as far as the aggregate hit to the individual?
Through the chair, yes, anytime a state imposes an income tax, that is, if an individual can itemize deductions on their federal income tax return, state income taxes are a deduction that you can take. So yes, there would be an offset provision. However, we don't really have the ability to accurately reflect that offset. But we know there will be. It won't affect the amount. We don't see it as a significant impact on the amount of revenue that would come in under these bills.
Follow-up, is there any way to even eyeball how much would, and just pick one, let's say a dual family income with $150,000 mortgage, how much is it going to cost them out of pocket? Not how much the state would get, but how much counting their federal income tax burden?
Through the chair, then, if we're looking at that dual income family, prior law, for example, okay, so they have an Alaska income tax of $2,269 that they're, if they were able to itemize deductions, which they have done in their that would then be, that would, that's roughly, they would get 15%. If you took 15% of that $2,269, that would be their federal tax savings for itemizing that amount.
They save $300 or $400.
If you then reworked the numbers, the state income tax wouldn't really reduce it by quite 15%. But
thank you.
I'm sorry, Roper.
I had a calculator real quick. We could get you the number.
$300 or $400 is what they'd save on their federal bill by paying us the $2,200.
Representative Samuels, through the chair, I just whipped out in the calculator. Yeah, $340, and then there'd be a slight iterative effect, but ballpark, that's correct.
All right, thank you.
I was just going to editorialize, Mr. Chairman, that depends unless you got hit with your AMT, but it might not. And then also, it's interesting to note that through the tax year of 2004, there will be a sales tax offset allowed in Alaska for the first time in decades. So that was one of the arguments before about when you measured or you tried to reach a policy conclusion about what was the most beneficial types of taxation. One of the arguments was the sales tax did not have the offset and the income tax did, but we'll see how this new provision under federal law does allow sales tax offset.
Yeah, through the chair, if I might, this is Mike Williams again. That sales tax deduction is only allowed for residents who live in cities and boroughs that impose a local sales tax. So, for example, if you live in Anchorage or Fairbanks, you cannot take benefit of that provision unless you actually paid, unless you have actual sales tax receipts paid anywhere in Alaska. But if, through the chair, if I might carry on the conversation here, if the state of Alaska did pass a statewide tax under federal law, we would then go back to the normal table.
Right.
And so I think Representative Roseberg's point is that in some sense that the a state's choice as to between income tax and sales tax has been equalized now in terms of its relationship to the federal deductibility of it.
And that was Mr. Dickinson for the record.
Yes, sir.
Representative Samuels.
Thank you. And following up now for Mr. Dickinson also on the legal size sheet where the under the prior law was been the $758 million. Under prior law, did that include LLCs and other type business entities, so you'd be the LLC would be taxed, and then would the income also be taxed on the individual, the owner of the LLC or the partnership?
Representative Samuels, now you're getting back into stuff that I maybe studied for my CPA exam, but in general, if you had a pass-through entity, it would have passed through and become part of your income base. The LLC in its current form didn't really exist or wasn't a widely used vehicle in 1977. But in general, the general rule is a self-employed or any pass-through would have shown up and would be in those figures.
And it would be taxed just once?
Representative Samuels, through the chair, yes. The whole point of a pass-through entity is it would be just taxed once at that level. At the owner level.
Okay, I'll have a whole lot more comments on that as we go down the road here.
We'll get to those specific bills, too, here.
Okay.
Any further questions on these general information in the committee? Here, Representative Roper.
Is Mr. Dickens going to talk about any state-adjusted gross sales, the Alaska gross state product, and those impacts in terms of taxation? There's in our packet, there's some terms.
Representative Roseberg, through the chair, yes, we have a package, and Brett Fried and the economists who assembled those will talk to those.
Okay.
We were just focusing now on the first on the item number one here, which is on the tax the comparison of these three income tax bills.
Thanks, Mr. Dickinson. Mr. Dickinson, were you prepared to go look at these individual bills, starting with the original bill the state of Alaska used to have?
Mr. Chairman, we actually didn't have we were not pre-
We do not have a I'll just answer the question. We didn't have a presentation ready to compare the three other than looking at the revenue issues under them. If there are specific questions, we may be able to address them, but we did not prepare a presentation. And I apologize if there was a miscommunication there.
Well, why don't we look at the original tax bill, and nobody online was around when those bills were in place, I assume, including you, Mr. Dickinson.
Well, I was around, but I wasn't. I think I showed up the year it was repealed.
I was.
Representative Moses, Representative Rogenberg. I was, I think most of us paid tax under the scheme.
I wrote a lot of those checks.
Yeah.
I think Representative Moses was in the legislature.
Right. Does anybody have any specific questions on the original tax scheme? Representative Roper?
What, Mr. Chairman, was Mr. Freed going to do this? Maybe we could do that and then go to the other ones. And
that's fine. Mr. Freed, you had prepared a colorful three sets of charts on the Alaska gross state product, the general revenue, fund revenue, and the Mr. Freed?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, for the record, it's Brett Freed, economist with Department of Revenue. And I, you should have three pie charts.
Yes.
And then I was just going to start, just go through them, you know, very quickly. The first pie chart I was going to talk about, the title is General Fund Revenue by Tax Type, Including Oil and Gas.
That's the second.
Right.
Big blue.
Go ahead.
This one was just to show that, you know, out of the $1.2 billion in fiscal year 2004 of the general fund tax revenue, 82% was oil and gas. And then the non-oil is about 18% or $240 million. Then I wanted to move on to the slide. So for the non-oil portion, the $240 million, then I prepared a separate slide. Oil and gas?
Excluding oil and gas?
Correct.
That just takes out the 18%?
Well, that takes out the 82%, the oil and gas one. It just shows the other pieces for the 18%. So just the $240 million in fiscal year 2004.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Seaton?
I'm just curious. The first one says Alaska gross state product, and that does not list oil and gas on there. Is that?
Through the chair?
Yes, Mr. Freed.
I was just going to get to the Alaska gross state pot, and I'll explain why that doesn't include oil and gas.
Go ahead.
But I was hoping to go through this one with the general fund tax revenue excluding oil and gas first.
Sure, go ahead.
So you have the insurance premium. That's the largest component there. At 20% or $49 million. And then the fish at 19%, but that includes all the shared taxes. It also includes the salmon and seafood marketing tax, the salmon enhancement tax, dive fishery management. And then we have the motor fuel at 17%, which is about $41 million. Our corporation general, which is 17%, at about $40 million. Actually, the motor fuel is about $41 million. Alcohol at 14%, which is about $33 million. And then tobacco at 7%, which is $16 million. And then I wanted to go to this Alaska gross state product slide.
Before we go on,
yeah, Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Freed, looking at the your last one that allocated the 18%, we noticed there's only 1% for mining. But does this include, you said like the fish area include all the shared revenue, but does this include the real and personal property taxes paid to like organized boroughs?
No, it doesn't. No, all it includes is the general fund mining taxes. So it does not include any of the local sales or property taxes. It doesn't include restricted revenues. For instance, in tobacco, it wouldn't include the school fund revenue.
But it does in the fish, and it does in the oil and gas?
Well, the fish, that is general fund revenue. The shared taxes, the seafood and salmon marketing tax revenue. It's not a, the school fund, that's actually a dedicated fund. It doesn't include any of the local sales tax.
As a, just a point of clarification, I know, for example, like Red Dog has a significant contribution to the Northwest Borough, and their amount of taxation, I don't think it's truly represented by the 1%. And also the legislature's made policy calls for investment credits for this spur mining and its Senate. So, because it kind of sticks out as a glaring issue here. I know Representative Seaton has expressed some concerns about that in the past. So it might be interesting to see the gross government take, you know, versus just the state GF take on some of that.
And I think, like on the fish tax, even though it shows money to the state, we all know that that money is really not for the general fund. It goes to specific purposes anyway. It's sort of a reappropriated out. Right. Well, there's certain components of those.
Yeah.
Well, I'd be interested to see that, because that's always one of the, that always kind of troubled me about who is paying what freight. Sure. And that has a factor in it. Mm-hmm. Also, frankly, in the oil and gas component, the real property tax, ad valorem tax assessments that go to the North Slope Borough, Fairbanks, and Valdez are significant. You know, so it should be apples and oranges anyway.
Apples and oranges in that you're talking about state income and versus...
Right, when you look at these different sources of funds and then what actually, what type of tax burden is on a particular industry or something.
Right. We had Seaton, Wilson, and then Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I believe the fish tax does include, like, all of the raw fish tax that's collected and then half shared back generally with the communities where that revenue is generated. But it doesn't include the severance tax, which is charged by boroughs as well. So that comes back to the same property. Because, like, we have, in some areas, there's a 7.5%, like Kodiak has, I believe it's 7.5% severance tax on all fish products that are landed. And so that's not included in here as well. And I think it'd be very, very helpful to have for each one of these industries the total tax and total contribution percentages. And so if revenue could do that, I think the committee...
You're looking at the total tax burden.
Total tax burden, yeah. Split it by category, for each industry. So we really know what's happening.
The new term of art, because of Wood Mackenzie, is government take.
Yeah.
You know, right?
Let's see.
Chairman, if I might, and we'll take that assignment, and just one of the, this is Dan Dickinson speaking, one of the points I'd like to make, and again, this may be by the time we're done, you'll get a very complex set of diagrams, but, you know, you can clearly say what's the total government take, and then, you know, if you look at sort of money that technically comes into the general fund and then the legislature appropriates back to an aquaculture association, you know, for example, to use, I think, you know, the state doesn't go to all the home builders, collect money from them, and then give that to the Alaska Home Builders Association. They've chosen to do that themselves. So, you know, there's government take, and then you can go, well, yeah, we have to take out the pieces that the government doesn't use, and it goes back, and is that general fund, and there isn't. My only point is, as we assemble that information and take the time to do a more detailed diagram, you will probably then come and want to challenge the various decisions we've made on doing this. No comparison like this is going to be simple, and will be open to varying interpretations.
Mr. Chairman, this is Brad again. Can I make another comment on that, if I may?
Certainly.
There also one other thing that's not included is other revenue sources such as licenses and permits, fines and forfeitures, charges for services. And these are actually more difficult to break out.
Is there an other category that you have a ballpark estimate?
No, I don't at this point.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, I mean, if you look at the general fund, you know, there's about $300 million in taxes. But if you start going to all the other pieces, you know, again, where you draw the lines can get more complex.
Sure.
And you're dealing here with, then you would have, you know, some of the restricted revenue, for instance, you know, all on license and permits, you'd have all the fish and game revenue from the fish and game permits in there. The 20-odd million would be in there. You'd have the tobacco settlement revenue that would be included under tobacco. And that kind of leads us into this Alaska gross state product, basically. The point here is how to break it out. The Alaska gross state product is sort of your economic measure of output in the economy.
Just a sec. We had a couple of questions before you move on. We had Representative Wilson and Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One was a comment and then a question. I know that's probably pretty difficult. If I recall right, because of the cuts that we've made in the Fish and Game Department, there was not enough money to do research in certain areas so that they could expand and do some things. And so I know that industry itself came to the state and said, if we tax ourselves, and will you use that money that we're taxing ourselves so that we can expand that program? So I know some of the areas are... it's kind of hard to figure out what was the reasoning behind some of the reasons that the money went to certain areas. But anyway, having said that, I'm not sure I understand the yellow part here where it says insurance premium was 20%. Will you explain that to me? Because I really just don't understand that. Mr. Fried, can you explain that a little bit? On the second page that we're looking at with the round circle and then the yellow part where it says insurance premium?
That's an insurance premium tax. That's in lieu of corporate income taxes or other state taxes. If you're an insurance company, you do not pay those taxes. Instead, you pay an insurance premium tax.
It's a tax on the premium paid by individuals or entities to the state of Alaska, passed through the insurance company. Is that what it is?
Yes, I believe so. Through the chair.
Okay. Yeah. Follow up, Representative Wilson, and then Representative Grunberg.
It's
Representative
in Title 21 in the insurance code.
Or on that point?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Representative Roper.
Okay. You know, it seems to me, gentlemen who are on the line, that... what we're really asking is something that maybe you couldn't put in a pie chart, but maybe you can list out for us, all just really breaking down all the various sources of revenue and the subcategories and the fines and the royalties and everything else. And I would like you, if you're going to do that in a comprehensive way, through the chair, I would request that be done, that also you list the various exemptions and how much, and credits, and how much they are worth, whether they're additions or credits or whatever. I'm interested specifically in one thing, and that is the university tax credits. I'm interested in knowing how much that is per year, and I would request, and I know this is going to be some work, when they do that, if they could go back for 3 or 4 years so we could see not just this year, but how these have varied over time a little bit. And we can compare them year by year because some of them are developing. Some of the new credits or new taxes, it takes a while before they mature and get online, and we can see what they're really worth to the state and to the citizens and taxpayers. And I would request that be done. I know that's going to take a little bit of time and be very comprehensive, but I think that will really help us see, Mr. Chairman, what is going on in this state.
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, this is Dan Dickinson speaking. We actually do a credits report. We can get that to you. I believe, are required by statute to do that report already. So in our operations report, we set out all credits that are taken. On the larger question, you know, in our revenue sources book, which we put out every 6 months, we take all the governmental funds, all governmental revenues as defined by the comprehensive annual report, and go through a very explicit listing on those, the taxes, the charges for services, things like that. Again, we draw the line around the governmental funds. That's roughly a $4 billion piece. As you said, you can go out and start looking, you know, try to find every resident, every special service, district that has a taxing authority for some specific purpose that will affect every landowner there, and try to figure out which corporations hold land there, what kinds they are. So it's where you draw those lines makes that exercise more or less useful and more or less difficult.
Mr. Chair, if I may follow up just
sure.
The question. I don't have a particular feeling, but I know other members of the committee do. I know Representative Roekberg has been asking, I think Representative Seaton possibly too. If we can get that stuff all together, I think that would be really helpful so we, members of the committee and staff, see what's going on here.
One thing I try and do is note committee members' requests for information and data, and I try and get that to the committee. If you have your own requests for information, please note them and give it to either me or staff so we can follow up on your requests too.
Okay,
during the
sure.
course of these meetings. Representative Roekberg, I had you down.
Yeah, it might be helpful if Representative Grunberg would maybe make a written. I wasn't sure exactly what you were, how broad that was.
Well,
it was
kind of
hard instructions for him.
Through the chair. My thought was just to make a general kind of a request and see how the members felt, and we could flesh that out a little bit. My specific question had to do with the university tax credits, but it seemed that the conversation around the table here had been to get a lot of additional information, and I thought that would probably be helpful, put it in a form so we could really all look at it.
Well, I think it's in the revenue source book in the main and some of these other reports. So, but anyway, Mr. Chairman, I did have a question, kind of technical. It's interesting to see the 20% insurance premium tax that generates here in the state. It's $49 million. And that's one thing as a member of Labor and Commerce for decades that why we want to invite more insurance companies here into the state to pay taxes and provide insurance coverage for our citizens. One of the biggest problems we have as a state is the barriers and the obstacles that even this legislature keeps putting up in the face of that without realizing they're a huge source of income. How ironic to see that they're actually paying more than general corporate taxes now. It's really interesting. But one thing I would like to ask the department is previously we used to receive, I think, anywhere from 9 to 12 million a year in mutual fund type fees through the Division of Banking and Securities. Is that still a source of income? I forgive me for not looking up the source book in front of me, but I don't have it in front of me. Where's that money?
Through the chair, that shows up under receipt supported services, under charges for services in the sources book. But that's just aggregated, and we don't break it out by specific.
Where is it in this chart?
We certainly could get you that number.
Well, where is it in this $240 million chart? Is what I'm asking.
Not in there because it's under it's a charge for that's a charge for services. That's not under a tax revenue. Not included.
The charge for services.
Well, there's a stretch, but thanks.
Thanks for asking, Michael.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm also concerned about the insurance premium. I mean, section there, it looks very large. Could we get a comparison, or could it be? Wouldn't have to be. I mean, a rough comparison would be good of what the insurance companies would be paying through corporate tax. I think I heard you said that this insurance premium was in lieu of corporate tax, so that we could get a kind of comparison of what these companies would be paying in corporate tax versus this insurance premium tax?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, this is Dan Dickinson. As a CPA, what I'd love to do is quit my job and have you pay me by the hour to do that comparison for you. One of the reasons that most states have gone to this is that the sort of, if you sit there and think about how much income a company makes, for an insurance company, when you get into this notion of, you know, they collect premiums, they invest them, they have payouts, when they actually earn their money, how they do it, it can be a field day for people like me and very frustrating for everyone else. Quite literally, one of the reasons that you see this, and in many states you also see it with banks and other kinds of financial institutions, is sitting down and coming up with a definition of income that matches up with a company that, you know, manufactures goods and sells them, or somebody who charges by the hour, is just simply impossible in today's world. So the short answer is no, we can't. And I think you'll find if we did, no matter what number you put out there, there'd be people banging on your door saying, don't listen to these guys. They don't know what they're doing.
Okay, but I did want to get, this is in lieu of corporate tax. Is that?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, that is correct.
Okay, thanks.
Representative Grunberg?
Just on that point, Mr. Chair, did I hear you, Mr. Dickinson, say that a number of states are now looking at a different way to tax, quote, banks and financial institutions, unquote, rather than through a general corporate tax?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, it is my belief that there are some states that deal with financial institutions and come up with a different measure than the typical gross income. If you want, before I get much further on this, you should probably let me do a little research. I was pulling some sort of stuff I've read out of the air. We do not, and I'm not, I couldn't really talk much more specifically on that at the moment.
I would appreciate it, through the chair, if you would do a little research and get back to us and specifically to me. I'm very interested in knowing a little more about that.
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, I hear the assignment.
I'm afraid if you quit your job and work for Representative Seaton, you wouldn't get much more money anyway. But. any further questions on this line? Yeah, Representative Grunberg.
Yeah, to follow up on my last question, are there any other specific kinds of industries where, with our increasing sophistication and technology, they are getting, other states are getting away from the general corporate tax and looking at alternative ways of taxing specific industries that may be more realistic?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, you know, let us not speculate. We can get back to you. One point which you may or may not find interesting is in the state of Alaska, telephone and electric cooperatives are exempted from income taxes and instead pay a fee calculated basically on their economic output.
I noticed.
So if you look, for example, in the revenue sources book, you know, if you look on your table that says the general fund tax revenue excluding oil and gas, you will see that the electrical and telephone co-ops representing 2% of that total, are carved out and exempted from paying an income tax.
Yes, I understand that. And I just, to go back a moment ago through the chair, I don't want you to make a career of this. I'm just looking at anything that looks like it might be worthwhile in this state. I really am just interested if there's something that really catches your eye.
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, we will see what we can locate.
Okay, Representative Seaton?
Yeah, thanks. I just want to make it clear that answer was good enough for me. I didn't need him to do a full-time employment trying to figure out that insurance stuff.
The point, Representative Seaton, but I hear you also.
Yeah. Okay, Representative Samuels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've got a question on the corporate income tax. On a national company, let's say, pick a Walmart. If Walmart lost money nationally, then they don't pay any tax up here no matter how their stores here did. Is that correct?
Representative Samuels, through the chair, That's correct. What matters is their, well, in the case of a Walmart, what would matter is their U.S. income.
Okay, thank you.
Through the chair, this is Mike Williams. I also caution about such analogies because separate accounting issues, often people say, well, if Walmart in Alaska will do great on any given day, separate accounting is open to manipulation as much as any other method of accounting.
Right. I didn't want to lose a comment Representative Roekberg made earlier, particularly with respect to the mining tax burden. We are going to look at tax issues on the non-oil and gas fields, including mining, and I wanted to make sure that we got the information that you were asking for when we looked at the tax burden, the mining companies, for example.
But yeah, I think actually the fisheries, certain other areas are where there is these shared revenues, and understanding what the total government take, because it's the impact on the industry we have to be sensitive to if there's any change in policy. So you have to look at the global impacts on their bottom lines and their taxing policy. That's the same problem with encroaching on like sales tax areas and how that impacts local governments, because they're in part dependent upon some of these other industries.
And Roekberg, through the chair, where that analysis then usually takes you on the next step is what services might they receive from the government, and you know, how do you differentiate those services by industry? And that, again, also isn't necessarily a transparent set of numbers to calculate.
Let's not create more work for you, Dan.
Appreciate that, sir.
All right. Representative Samuels.
I have one last question on just general information before we get into some of the specifics. S-corps, you know, if a private doctor or lawyer or LLCs, they pay no taxes at all? Is that true?
Representative Samuels, through the chair, when they file a federal return, you have the option, an LLC has the option, if you are simply organized as a partnership, for example, you don't have the option, but you can create what's called a pass-through, in which case the entity pays no tax except in certain special circumstances, and it's the owners that receive their due share of the income and then pay tax on it if such a tax is appropriate.
And do you have any idea on those two entities, LLCs or S-corps, on how much revenue, if just on those, if we implemented these various bills, would be included in the revenue figures? Any way to tell that without becoming a full-time job?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, we actually have done that work for S-Corps. The ballpark figure, and that we can dig it out, and I believe we've presented to the committee earlier the real numbers, but I think it's roughly $30 million under current law if we simply taxed, in other words, we considered S-corporations the same as we tax C-corporations.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The S corporations don't pay the taxes, but presumably the money is passed through and the individuals who receive it pay the taxes. Is that correct?
Through the chair, yes, the owners are then subject to any tax that's appropriate. So in our state, for example, they will pay federal tax, but because there is no individual income tax, they will pay none. In a state with an individual income tax, they would pay both the federal and that state's income tax.
So the $30 million, is that really lost to the state then?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, what we have calculated is if you decided to tax them at the entity level, here's what would occur. What we haven't done is said if you had a pass-through and a personal income tax, how much would we pick up from that? Because then you get into a whole different set of circumstances because you have to combine whatever that pass-through income is with all the other aspects of their federal income tax or their state income tax situation.
Thank you.
Representative Chair, if there are no more questions, if Brett could proceed with his presentation.
Is there any more questions from the Chair? Okay, thank you, Mr. Dickinson. Go ahead, Mr. Fried.
The last slide is this Alaska growth state product slide, and as was noted, you know, there is no oil and gas extraction on this, and this is actually the data. This is data from the Bureau of Economic Analysis, and they use the North American Industrial Classification System, which is what essentially all government entities do when they classify industries. So this would be the classification for earnings, for employment, and in this case, we're looking at growth state product. What they do for mining is then mining is further broken out, and part of the mining is oil and gas extraction, and then another part, which is about 16% of it. And then you have support activities for mining. Now, how much of that support activities is oil and gas, or how much of it is mining? You know, I don't know. You'd have to do some more research to maybe find that out if we could. And then you have the mining except oil and gas, which is 2%. But for instance, if you were looking at oil and gas industry, you wouldn't be able to just stay with the oil and gas extraction under mining, because the oil and gas industry, of course, you'd have also under manufacturing, you'd have oil and gas refining. Under transportation, you would have the oil and gas pipeline. And this is the same. You may have looked on here and gone, you know, where is fish under here? And the only place you can find it on this pie chart is under agriculture, forestry, fishing, and hunting. That would only include fish harvesting. Seafood processing would be under manufacturing. So probably about 1% of that manufacturing that you see there would be the seafood processing. And the fish harvesting is not specifically broken out, as far as I could find out, by the Bureau of Economic Analysis. So you'd have to go to essentially other sources. And then if you go into something like, for instance, tourism even is more difficult, because tourism, you're involved in many of these different industries. And even when you get down to the, for instance, you get down to accommodation and food services, then you would need to know, well, how much of the accommodations is of the output from the accommodation industry is due to tourists versus, you know, business travel or local travel, and the same with food services. So there are just a lot of complexities involved, and this wouldn't just be for Alaska growth state product. It would be no matter what you chose as your sort of economic measure.
Representative Roper.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, so our gross state product is $29.7 billion in 2002, according to the U.S. Department of Commerce.
Correct.
It's kind of interesting to see the mining component versus the seafood and fishing component here. It's kind of shocking in a way. Is this because of offshore processing, Representative Seaton? Our added value isn't working here, or what?
I think if we're talking about the first slide there that we have, Alaska state growth product, I think I heard him say that the mining 21% included oil and gas.
Through the chair, that's correct.
So was your figure 2% of that mining section is minerals?
2% is mining except oil and gas. And on the oil and gas part, that would just be the oil and gas extraction component, which is 16% of it. And then you have the support activities for mining, which is the remaining 3%. And that would include oil and gas support activities.
Okay. Further comment or question? Go ahead, Mr. Freed.
But that's all I had on that.
Mr. Chairman, if I could jump in here, Dan Dickinson speaking again, you know, and the point I want to make is, this may not have drawn the lines that you asked us to draw. What it showed you is, here's the data we start to work with. if we were going to do a lot more work on it, you know, the next step would be sitting down and defining the project more precisely, defining the areas. You know, when we don't have the ability, either the resources to do a lot of this research on our own, or the statutory authority to go out and conduct these kind of services and require census information, we're left using other people's data, and it may not line up with the categories that you think of as being the primary ones that we should be comparing. So the point I'm trying to make here is, you know, what may sound like a relatively simple exercise is a complex one, both in the terms of what needs to be done, and secondly, in terms of the kinds of definitions that need to be done that we need to understand, you know, again, why we are doing these comparisons, and that gets into the definition. So a long way of saying these are the steps we've taken so far, and, you know, I hope that illustrates the complexity that would be involved in bringing this project to the completion that you may have envisioned.
Sure, Representative Roper.
Is the medical provider and service, is that under services, the 20% there, medical provider?
Through the chair, Representative Roachberg, that is correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to point out the real estate 9% is about at least only half of what oil and gas is in the state, just for editorial comment.
All right. Any further questions on this? I would like to get a Representative Moses, since you had introduced a bill that we had considered during the 23rd legislature, and Representative Wilson, just to get a brief philosophic discussion going here, and then we can look at the specific impacts. But my understanding, Representative Moses, when on the introduction of your House Bill 40 last legislature, that one of the primary concerns is that there was a number of people that were coming to Alaska and not paying an income tax, and your effort was to try and at least get those folks that were working in the, say, the oil and gas or fishing industries. I know those are two primary industries that are always pulled out as examples to try and get them to contribute to local government.
Yeah, that's correct. The chances of a non-resident worker having property tax credit would be quite remote, and if he did invest in the state, he'd be entitled to the credit. There's another catch to that. Areas of the state that do not have property taxes would not get any credits either. And of course, my original intent was to get something on the table, and the percentage of tax could be adjusted accordingly to whatever we wanted to raise. And one thing that concerns me is whether fishermen are considered independent businessmen or labor. I know for in settlements they get a 1099, there's no taxes withheld. I would expect they'd be classified as independent businessmen.
Mr. Chairman. Representative Seaton.
At least under the previous tax that we had, fishermen were, if you received the 1099, you had to file your state taxes and as a business, and you wrote the check out, the 14%, or I think is what it was. I may have a percentage a little off. And you wrote that percentage of your federal taxes. You know, the 1099 is a federal tax form. And you have to do federal taxes. You wrote a percentage of that and sent it in. So, you know, I would presume that we want to make sure that we don't just tax, you know, people that are employed if we're setting up tax. I mean, fishermen as independent businessmen are need to be taxed just like any other businessman. I think that's important not to lose sight of that revenue.
Representative Roper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd just like to say that I've never been a great fan of writing checks to governments taxes like most of our constituents and the citizens of the state. So I'd preface the remark here I'm about to make. I'm not a fan of income taxes. However, I want to compliment Representative Moses. I've always been intrigued with this concept that he brought forward a number of years ago, because as he says, it has the beauty of being a more like a rifle approach to those elements of the working public in our state that doesn't make a contribution. That is, more specifically, the out-of-state workers and the unorganized borough. Because by allowing a real property tax credit against your liability, those people who own property, as a matter of fact, I think there's been I have a legal opinion that says not just residential property, but it would be any owner of property that paid property taxes in the state of Alaska would have to be allowed to have the credit for equal protection and constitutional provisions. But at any rate, this has that element that has been one of the leading arguments for some type of a broad-based type tax, because there was people in our labor force coming to the state not making a contribution. And this would also could lower the burden on everybody. That's why the chart, this is drafted on the original draft, there's never been a lot of work on the bill that shows those holes in middle income. One thing I would say, that the principle of the exemption, I think, is something that should be considered in any future tax scheme in Alaska, and it could be applied to any of the other bills. We could apply the same exemption to the schedules in the old rate, Representative Wilson's bill, whatever one the legislature might want to take up, thereby raising the total revenue stream on the bill and still be consistent with the policy statement that you want to exempt those people that are already paying other taxes to their local government. So don't just look at the $100 million figure comparatively and just say that doesn't work, because that's not, this is just a basic concept. So, and I want to again applaud Representative Moses for forward thinking on this and trying to use a wrinkle that spreads the tax and the cost of government here more equitably around the state. And that's, I think, is an attempt here.
Representative Wilson.
I just want to make a comment here, too. I follow what you're saying, but on the other hand, I feel that there are people in the state that don't own property that do pay indirectly, because the expenses that the landlord has, he usually passes on to the renter. And so indirectly, they are paying that tax. It might not be mentioned as a tax, but I think that, yeah, most people that are landlords will see what their expenses are, see how they can get back their, you know, to make a profit, and so they go ahead and just up the rent. If the tax went up, then they probably would up the rent a little bit and to make up for that. So indirectly, I think that maybe people do pay. I mean, that's just another philosophy, another way to look at it.
So. Representative Samuels.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To follow up on Representative Wilson's comments, if you don't have the exemption, you cost the property owner more, the rents will go up, because it's not sometimes that the expenses get passed through. It's every time your expenses go up, they get passed through.
Good.
Any, you want to talk about your bill? That basically, that was a thumbnail of it. Okay. And then, Representative Wilson, you had an income tax bill, and I think I was correct in that when I, Representative Roper and I sort of traded comments, there was some discussion about some tie-in to the value of the constitutional budget reserve in terms of when that tax would kick in. Isn't that right? Or do you recall that?
You know, I don't.
Because that was one of the more interesting parts of the discussion, I thought.
We did talk about it, but I'm not sure that we incorporated it into that bill. I mean, there's several different things we incorporated. In fact, we wanted to make sure that we did touch the fishing industry. So we even made requirements that there was a warning printed on when they bought their fishing license, that it said that you will be taxed, you know, and that you're responsible for turning in the information. So we did make sure we did that. It was a notice to be printed on the commercial fishing license applications, warning that the income from that was taxable. So there we actually, because there was a real concern that everybody wasn't paying their fair share, so we kind of incorporated something similar to the education tax in section two of the bill. It imposes an income tax of 3% of the federal taxable income tax, or $100, whichever is greater. So to make sure that everyone paid something, if it came out that they didn't owe anything, they would at least owe $100. So that people that were low income, and we were trying to cover the base where there were people that were property owners that didn't feel the rest of them were paying their fair share. So to incorporate that, we slid that into that, just to make sure that everyone paid something. So that was taken care of in section two. In section three was just a conforming amendment to a corporate income tax. And then section four actually required the taxpayers to file a return and remit their tax on the same day that their federal return was due. And those that owed $100, they could have the tax deducted from the permanent fund if they so wished. And non-residents whose only income in the state is from a trust or a corporation that would withhold the taxes, and they could file returns that way. And then there was it caps the tax liability at $20,000 for individuals and $30,000 for joint filers, for married people. And that was, I'm not sure I feel comfortable with that, but what we did is try to please everyone, and when you try to please everyone, that's what happens. So we ended up with a floor that didn't go any lower than $100, and a ceiling that didn't go any higher than $30,000. And there was actually, because we were trying to pull, I guess, in the education tax, there was an age limit too, which was 19 at the time. These were all things that we were just kind of playing with, and that's kind of the reason why there's different sections of the bill and why they were there. And then actually then some of the employers, going back to the education tax, some of the employers were could withhold some of that tax. So it's
Mr. Chairman, if I could just add one thing, and I believe that there was also a tax bill offered by Representative Wilson, and I believe that is the one that had the trigger associated with a CBRF in it last session.
Which bill?
Which bill are you referring to, Mr. Dickinson?
I'm sorry, I don't have those numbers in front of me. I might grab it for you in a moment here.
Well, that's all right. I know the conversation takes place, and I've got it in my file. So, I did have a question on your matrix. Who prepared the matrix? Was it Mr. Williams or Mr. Freed on the legal size chart?
Williams.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the question.
No, the question is there's asterisks under the HB 470 scenario across horizontally across the page. Can you just define the asterisk there for my notes?
The asterisk, the reason for that is that the way House Bill 470 is designed, that it's very difficult to give a distributional analysis of how much of the total revenue, how much comes from each class of income. And so, because I don't know where all the homeowners are under each class of income, and the way I had to estimate total revenue under House Bill 470 was more of an aggregate approach of looking at total gross income in the state, and then do an assumed rate of home ownership, how many of those people would then be eligible for credits and how much of that would then come out of the so mechanically speaking, I couldn't then attribute that total back into any particular income group. So that's why it's just asterisk means I couldn't really give you a distributional analysis there.
But you're able to come up with some total gross income from the implementation of the tax in that bill.
That is correct. That's what the $107 million represents.
All right.
Chairman, this is Dan Dickinson. If I can answer your previous question, that was HB 236, and you have the House Ways and Means CS, Section 3 of that, 4355011, has in it the billion-dollar CBRF floor, and then a cut out again when you were, the tax was suspended when you were greater than $2.5 billion. So that's HB 236, Representative Wilson's bill.
All right. And just, Representative Roper.
I think it has the fingerprints of myself and Representative Hocker all over it.
That's right. That's right. And just so I don't forget, Representative Roberg, you had asked a number of questions about the last bill we were deliberating on the use of the Constitutional Budget Reserve and the permanent fund earnings fill any gap, and those legal questions have been asked. We haven't received any answers yet. So,
Mr. Chairman. We're going to wrap this up here quickly. I had a couple of questions on the original tax.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I was looking at, looking back to the, Mr. Dixon, looking back to the 2002 revenue source book analysis of an income tax, could you just explain to the committee, use the $750 million plug number you have in the spreadsheet here, but then you adjusted for inflation of $660 million. You just want to explain that to the committee very briefly. Is that the nominal dollars versus the inflated dollars? And is it, and then the, I'm trying to say I don't have that in front of me here. There it is. The highest raised, it was $210 million. So the inflator is up to $66 million, and the gross would be $750 million. I'm looking at the 2002 source book analysis here.
Through the chair, this is Mike Williams, Representative Roberg. That is correct. That the for the 2002 revenue sources, there again, if we just took the actual old law unchanged. Dollars comes from, and that's what I presented here to the committee today. But if we had adjusted the brackets as for inflation, then that's where the $660 million comes from. And just professional opinion here, in all honesty, I don't think the old law would have survived intact to the present day. You quite honestly would have had a tax revolt such that the brackets would have been simplified. The personal income tax more than likely would have regressed to a more national average, which is roughly 6 or 7% of federal taxable income, in which case the revenue from that tax law would probably only be in the $300 to $350 million range.
Well, yeah, that's what I recollect from conversations over the years, where the anticipated revenue source for a statewide income tax would probably be in the $350 to $500 million range max, not the $750 million.
Right, the 750 is just true. Is just a true representation. Is if the old law is in place today and had not been changed whatsoever.
Yeah, it would really be helpful for the committee, I think, to if you could flesh out the comment you just made about the tax revolt potentialities and what more national figures are. I think it might be helpful for the committee to have something like that. If there's a some type of a article or some research that you can rely on without having to do.
Well, why don't you just orally just expand on that a little bit?
Right.
Through the chair, this is Mike Williams. The appendix of the tax division's annual report, we do include a rate a chart showing the personal income tax rates of the various states in the nation, and that's in the appendix. I think it's Appendix A, or Appendix, somewhere in one of these appendices has the, Appendix B of the tax division's annual report. And just quickly scanning down the list, it's we can provide this to the committee, but it's the highest average rate nationally. It tends to be in the 5 to 7% range on predominantly it's taxable, federal taxable income is the tax base that most states use for personal income taxes. But we can certainly provide that chart to the committee.
And could you compare to what the effective rate would have been under the old tax, or would you rather not do that?
If the old tax effective rate had remained in place, we would be the highest taxing state in the nation. I mean, there's no question there.
All right. One question I did have is, if adjusted for inflation, if the income tax the state had on the books were still on the books and we would receive $660 million annually, how does that compare? We don't have this information except for the comparative analysis of how much taxes are paid. How does that compare with the oil and gas revenues to the state?
Through the chair, I believe the oil and gas revenues to the state are in the neighborhood of about $2 billion, or roughly.
So roughly a quarter.
Okay. Essentially, yes.
All right. Any further questions about these issues from the committee? Comments? Representative Roper?
Mr. Chairman, I think it's important that we maybe pursue this last line of questioning a little further so we have a better handle on it, because if you just look at the stuff that we talked about this morning without putting it in a national context, I think it would not be fair to the committee or our own education, but because it really speaks to one of my concerns about whether the state can afford itself if we can max or cap out whatever form of tax and what we could look at in terms of potential revenue, where are we headed?
Right.
You know, 5, 10 years, 20 years from now. I mean, what kind of anticipated revenue streams under the worst kind of scenarios we could have, and what we can even rely on in the future? And that's a concern I have. And so we shouldn't look at like a $750 million potential tax revenue stream when in fact it would be cause a mutiny. You know?
That's right, and it would cause outflow of all kinds of industry and people.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the impacts on the economy would be devastating, I think. You know,
sure, there's no question. And we're not going to take that up and avoid. We don't have time to take it up now, but we definitely need to address that. Okay, committee's adjourned. Thank you, gentlemen.